So during my sabbatical this spring, while visiting my mother, I went exploring small villages in the south of England to learn more about the UK Unitarians. Villages with beautiful 16th-century cottages, village greens, the requisite tea shops. If they had nothing else, they had tea shops. And the kind of church tower that Sam showed earlier that you can see from 3 fields away, calling everyone in the parish to the local Church of England on a Sunday morning. But try as I might, I had a hard time finding the Unitarians. Until tucked down a small lane or behind a hedge or stone wall, almost invisible if you weren't looking for it, I kept finding these other buildings. Meeting houses, small, plain, no steeple, no stained glass announcing itself to the road. Instead, they looked like ordinary houses. But if you looked closely, you'd see a small sign out front saying Unitarian. Shh. Because after the Reformation, England had settled on one official church, the Church of England, and you were expected to belong to it. And if you didn't, you were considered a heretic. You could lose your position at a university, you could lose your income, and in earlier centuries, you would lose your freedom or even your life. The people who refused to conform came to be called dissenters and nonconformists. Not only Unitarians, but also Quakers, Baptists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Protestants of all kinds, all of them worshiping outside the state church at real personal and legal risk. Many met in private houses before they were ever able to build anything at all. And when they finally did, they built inconspicuous meeting houses rather than churches because that's what the law and their neighbors would tolerate. A church was for the established faith. A meeting house was for the nonconformists, and they didn't want to draw too much attention to themselves. Early Unitarians, of course, as many of you know, were influenced by Socinians and Unitarians in Transylvania, whom I talked about last week, and also Poland. But many non-Trinitarians, later known as Unitarians, were persecuted and imprisoned for their beliefs for hundreds of years. So the reason these meeting houses were built rather than churches had little to do with aesthetics and almost everything to do with courage, vision, and persistence in spite of persecution. It was only in 1813, with the Doctrine of the Trinity Act, that it became legal to be Unitarian in the UK. So that's when bigger churches I visited, like Roslyn Hill in London and the Brighton Church, were built. Here you see Roslyn Hill looking like a beautiful Church of England, and it has stained glass, but very specific Unitarian stained glass, which was built 1865, I believe. But the UK Unitarian congregations that I visited in the small towns of Ditchling, Lewes, and Godalming were relegated to meeting houses. So as you might imagine, it's hard for many British Unitarian congregations to get known. It's less of a PR issue and more that you wouldn't even know that they existed. So first, I visited Ditchling, a picturesque little hamlet in East Sussex. The meeting house is not viewable from any street, and it needs to be approached via a tiny walking path called a twitten, which is literally a path between houses. You'll see right there. The church is on the right, but there's no street there, no parking spaces, nothing like that. It was built for the General Baptists in 1650, and along with other Baptist chapels, it became Unitarian in the mid-1700s. Here's the Ditchling Meeting House. On the right is the meeting house. Walking into that tiny meeting house, surrounded by fields of graves in which many of the dissenters had been buried, the history felt palpable. And apparently, a number of its members were even buried under the church floor. You wouldn't be able to tell there, but they are under that church floor. there was history oozing out of every wall, window, and stone, and I felt a sense of awe for the generations of brave souls that had come before. There was even a secret door on the left that led to the adjoining house built in 1672, where ministers and their families lived for centuries, though now they rented out as their main source of income. Because with 5 to 10 members, you don't get a lot of income coming in. And then I learned that UK congregations don't actually hold offerings during their service, wanting not to impose. It's very British. They simply place a plate surreptitiously at the exit door, hoping that people will contribute. And I find myself smiling about the English Reserve and then worrying, because their reluctance to ask anyone to give made me wonder whether a community can survive if everyone assumes someone else will keep the doors open and they never ask for help. And what I saw was congregations really struggling. Lovely buildings, but very few people in them. After Ditchling, I spent some time exploring the Sussex town of Lewes, known for its nonconformists and dissenters even today. And that's where I found tributes to the English-American founding father, Thomas Paine. See the plaque right there. Most people know him from Common Sense, the pamphlet that turned colonial grumbling into a vision for outright independence. But fewer people know that before any of that, Paine spent 6 years in the small English town of Lewes, working as an excise officer and lodging above a tobacco shop in a building called Bull House. To the left is Bull House. And I stood outside it on the high street in Lewes. And the building has a really strange history. In the late 1600s, a Unitarian minister named Thomas Barnard bought the property and split it into two. The front on the left became Bull House and was the inn where Paine lodged. And the back, that you see where that blue door is, became Westgate Chapel, a dissenting congregation with its own ministers, its own elders, and its own small lending library. Paine wasn't just living next to, this is the back of that building, and you can see the chapel there. So it was hidden, you wouldn't see, it looked even a bit churchy. Paine wasn't just living next door to that chapel, he was living in the other half of the same building. His brother-in-law was the minister there, his father-in-law was an elder, and it was during those Lewes years, arguing late into the night at a local debating club called the Headstrong Club, that he sharpened the convictions that would later become part of the US founding documents. 2 years after leaving Lewes, Paine sailed for America. And within a year of arriving, he published the pamphlet that helped light a revolution called the American Crisis. The dissenting spirit that the Bull House and Westgate Chapel had inspired in him crossed the Atlantic and found a much larger vision. I really wanted to see that chapel inside and experience some of what he might have felt. But sadly, I couldn't. You'll see a sign there describing Westgate Chapel. The Unitarians who still call Westgate Chapel their spiritual home, unfortunately, no longer meet there. Sadly, a former board member went rogue and took control of the building, evicted the Unitarian congregation, and turned it into a venue for private hire, film nights, folk music, and wedding receptions. And that's what those signs describe. Yeah, so the congregation that grew out of Barnard's dissenting tradition, the same tradition that shaped Paine, now meets instead in a borrowed Church of England hall a few streets away. And needless to say, they are heartbroken, and they spend a lot of their time, energy, and resources trying to get their chapel back. It was a sad state of affairs. Here was a building that existed in the first place because people refused to worship inside the establishment's walls. Some freedoms are lost to riots and mobs, the way Priestley's church was in the story that you heard earlier, and others are lost more quietly. A lock subtly changed, a booking calendar filled with someone else's events, until one day there is nowhere left to gather. I think about that chapel the Unitarians of Lewes have lost, and the space that we still have here. And even though we don't have our beautiful sanctuary next door anymore, we at least have our own space here, and I invite us not to take it for granted. It's a precious gift. But back to the UK. To see this nonconformist history at its most alive, I met up with one of my colleagues, Reverend Adam Slade, who is the minister of a vibrant congregation in Newington Green on the edge of London in the Islington area called New Unity. And there's Adam, Reverend Adam, outside New Unity. New Unity was built in 1708, and it still has its original box pews intact. There's no moving chairs around inside that building. For over 300 years, it's been known as the oldest surviving dissenters' chapel in London. And during the 18th century, it became a center for rational dissent, encouraging people to think for themselves. And the walls are covered in history. And there are many plaques to the famous people who spent time developing their ideas there. I learned that a minister named Richard Price preached there for over 30 years. And Price wrote in support of American colonists before independence was even declared. His pamphlet on civil liberty sold so widely in the colonies that it's said to have outsold nearly every other piece of writing about the revolution. And later, he also preached in support of the French Revolution. He had a vision of democracy before it existed. Meanwhile, a young woman named Mary Wollstonecraft opened a school for girls on that same green where New Unity is. She became known as the founding mother of feminism. Mary got to know Price, sat in his congregation, and eventually wrote a vindication of the rights of woman. She had a vision of equal rights for women long before society did. So I really like to imagine what coffee hour must have been like there. Democracy on one side of the room, the rights of women on the other. I found myself hoping that our coffee hour conversations are still places where new ideas and hope-filled visions are born. And I invite you to create those kinds of coffee hours. So later in the 1700s, 2 years before the Declaration of Independence was signed in the Americas, a Church of England vicar named Theophilus Lindsay resigned his living because he could no longer honestly recite the words of the Trinitarian Creed. He decided he'd rather lose his career than keep repeating something he did not believe. And it says on his tombstone that Lindsay resigned his preferment in the church for the sake of truth and a good conscience. Now that's Unitarian, isn't it? But of course, freedom of conscience and speech rarely come without cost. And Lindsay paid for his heresy with his career and his pension. But he decided that his ministerial integrity and authenticity were worth it. So in April of 1774, fueled by his vision, he opened a small chapel in Essex Street in London, the first congregation in England to call itself openly and unapologetically Unitarian. 200 people came to that first service, and a fellow dissenter named Joseph Priestley, and sitting quietly in the pews too was Benjamin Franklin. Although the chapel itself no longer exists, UK Unitarian headquarters are still based in Essex Street, and they are refurbishing an old hall there now to house Unitarian events and alternative worship. And of course, there was Joseph Priestley, the same minister scientist you heard about in our story earlier. And as you heard earlier, Priestley was a Unitarian minister as much as a scientist, and I know we have many fantastic scientists in this room. He was also an educator and an outspoken supporter of both the American and French revolutions. And he believed that ordinary people were capable of thinking for themselves, which was a dangerous thing to believe out loud in Birmingham in 1791. He envisioned a society where science, faith, education, and democracy all belonged together. I think we still want to create that kind of society today. But that July, on the anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, the traditional mob came for him. And though he escaped with his life, his house, his laboratory, and his church were burned behind him. So in 1794, devoted to his vision and seeking safer territory, he and his family sailed for America and settled in rural Pennsylvania, as you heard earlier, in a town called Northumberland. It was close to Philadelphia, where he helped influence the founding of its first Unitarian congregation, now known as the First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia. The same current of dissent and vision had been quietly moving through these English meeting houses and crossed the Atlantic. Now, I don't want to overstate this connection, but there is a Unitarian thread that runs closer to our own founding documents than most of us were ever taught. Founding Father John Adams grew up congregationalist in Braintree, Massachusetts, in a church tradition that was drifting quietly and without much fanfare toward the same anti-Trinitarian conclusions Lindsay and Priestley had first reached in England. Adams spent his whole life at First Parish Church in Quincy, a congregation that eventually became explicitly Unitarian. Later in life, he wrote to his son, John Quincy Adams, that he considered himself a Unitarian, unable to accept that three could be one and one could be three, as it's spoke of in the Trinity. And he's buried today in a crypt beneath that same Unitarian church, together with his son, in what is now known as the Church of Presidents. Meanwhile, Thomas Jefferson never joined a Unitarian congregation, but in his own letters, he called himself a Unitarian too. When he had the chance to attend a Unitarian service, he preferred it to anything else on offer. And he even predicted in 1822 that Unitarianism would eventually become the dominant faith of America. So right. Sadly, he was wrong about that. Although we can always keep working on that and keep hoping, right? Because I think we are a faith of this time. Interestingly, both presidents, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, died on the 4th of July, 1826, exactly 200 years ago yesterday. And it made me reflect on the Declaration of Independence, which is, of course, not a Unitarian document, but the same insistence on the freedom to think for yourself, the same refusal to let a distant authority dictate the shape of your conscience, was moving through Newington Green and Essex Street, as well as Philadelphia and Boston, at almost exactly the same historical moment. And then, of course, it shows up a generation later in William Ellery Channing and in Theodore Parker and then Ralph Waldo Emerson and eventually in us. But back to the old meeting houses in the UK. Here was another one, standing inside those humble buildings this spring, this one with its minister in Godalming. I started to see them differently. They aren't relics. They're evidence. Every worn pew, every uneven paving stone, every plain pulpit with no gold on it anywhere exists because somebody decided they would rather not compromise their beliefs despite the implications. And in each of those tiny congregations today was a handful of faithful people keeping a building and a congregation alive. Those congregations have survived because generation after generation, somebody has quietly said, I'll unlock the doors this Sunday and I'll make some tea. And somebody balances the accounts and somebody repairs the leaking roof. And somebody kept believing that this tiny chalice flame in this tiny chapel matters Interestingly, some of the trustees weren't even members of the congregation, but they believed in the importance of maintaining the building as the historical evidence of dissent and vision. So what's made these congregations survive isn't their theology, nor their numbers or their money. It was ordinary people showing up generation after generation, refusing to let the flame go out on their watch. Now that's dedication. And I watched as one or two volunteers worked countless hours, almost like another full-time job, just to keep things going in these tiny congregations. And it was deeply touching. So here's what I think Lindsay, Priestley, Price, and Wollstonecraft all understood, and what I think they'd want us now in 2026 to remember. Every generation assumes that freedom and of conscience and belief is settled, that the argument has been won, the law has been passed, and now we can relax. Yes, I see the chuckles there, or the wry smiles. Because history keeps telling us otherwise, doesn't it? The freedom to question, to disagree, to worship differently, to welcome people other institutions turn away, none of that stays secured on its own. It has to be tended. It has to be argued for, and sometimes rebuilt from the ashes of someone's laboratory. And it has to be cultivated in our vision of the future. The people who built these meeting houses knew that in their bones. So, my friends, as America celebrates 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, we've been hearing a great deal about societal greatness and freedom. But I find myself this week equally grateful for a quieter freedom that came of age at the very same moment. The freedom to search, the freedom to question, the freedom to change our minds, to follow our own conscience, even when it leads somewhere inconvenient or perhaps dangerous, and to advocate ongoingly for our freedoms and democracy. And that freedom didn't begin in Philadelphia. It was carried there by refugees, by immigrants, and heretics who'd already paid for it once in England and other parts of Europe. Nonconformists who were willing to keep paying for it in a new country that wasn't entirely sure what to make of them either. So here's what I want you to carry out the door with you today. We didn't invent this tradition. We inherited it. The freedom of conscience we practice in this room on Sunday mornings was hard won. One refusal at a time by people who paid for it with their careers, their safety, sometimes their homes and lives. And this freedom only stays ours as long as we keep choosing it out loud together. And it only stays ours if we nurture its flame as spiritually courageous people who transform the world with justice and compassion and with care and determination. One day, hopefully, future generations will inherit Chalice, just as we inherited Ditchling and Godalming and other little meeting houses hidden down country lanes. My friends, may we be worth inheriting from. And may we continue to carry our free tradition forward with courage, with persistence, and intent. May it be so.